Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. Our program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Every day, we bring you news and information about America and the world. This is what you will hear on our program. We bring you a cultural story about Thailand. Next is our popular program, Words and Their Stories. Then, learn more about American universities on our Higher Education series. But first, this report.
Last week, an American court ruled against three members of a militia in the state of Kansas. The jury found the three men, Curtis Allen, Patrick Stein, and Gavin Wright, guilty of two charges, plotting to use a weapon of mass destruction and conspiracy against civil rights. They face up to life in prison. Officials say the three planned to bomb a building where Somali refugees live. They said the bombing was supposed to lead to more violence, what one of the men called Crusades 2.0. But their plan was stopped after their arrest, just weeks before the 2016 elections in the United States. Officials say the plot shows the changing enemy of a movement that was launched a generation ago. It began at a time of anti-government activism. But with the election of Donald Trump as president, the desire to fight the government appears to have lost some of its urgency. Many militia members support Trump and his policies. Instead of denouncing the government, militias have instead turned their hatred against new enemies: Muslims, immigrants, and the anti-fascist group Antifa. Some militias have been directing their attention to secondary enemies for the movement, notes Mark Pitcavage of the Anti-Defamation League Civil Rights Group. Often grouped with other extremist organizations, the anti-government movement comes in different forms. There are preppers, a term used to describe how they prepare for civil unrest by keeping large amounts of water and food. There are survivalists, people who learn skills to live off the land after a disaster. And then there are the militiamen who take part in military-style training exercises. Their aim is to resist a government they see as secretly planning to take away their guns and constitutional rights. The Southern Poverty Law Center, SPLC, says the modern U.S. militia movement dates back to a series of events in the early 1990s. Among them was the election of Bill Clinton as president in 1992, and an attack the following year on the Branch Davidian camp in Waco, Texas. The center says militias believe that attack by federal agents was evidence of an out-of-control government willing to attack citizens. During Clinton's presidency, the number of anti-government groups rose sharply, but it fell during George W. Bush's two terms as president, before rising again to 1,360 under President Barack Obama. In 2016, there were 689 anti-government groups nationwide, including 273 militias, according to the SPLC. The militia movement's hatred for Muslims was influenced in part by the 2008 election of Obama, the country's first African-American president. Some Americans believe that Obama was a Muslim born in Kenya. They accuse him of being a liberal who would take away citizens' guns. Adding fuel to anti-Muslim hatred were a series of terrorist attacks in Europe and the U.S. They included shootings carried out by Muslim extremists in Chattanooga, Tennessee, San Bernardino, California, and Orlando, Florida. The U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation was concerned. As early as May 2015, the FBI warned that militia extremists were expanding their targets to include Muslims and Islamic religious institutions in the United States. Because of its anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant language, the 2016 election campaign influenced some militiamen to take action. It was around this time that the three men began plotting to blow up the Somali housing complex in Kansas. The men belonged to the Kansas Security Force, which was part of a larger group called the Three Percenters. Along with a few other militiamen, they began meeting on Saturdays and Sundays to discuss ways to remove Muslims from the country. They formed a group to communicate and shared anti-Obama, anti-Clinton, and anti-Muslim memes on Facebook. Using Google Earth, the Kansas militiamen identified Muslim targets in the state. They then decided to attack the Somali apartment building and a religious center. To show just how extreme the three were, government lawyers questioned other members of the Kansas Security Force. One said that he left the militia after hearing about the plot. He said he had concerns that it was turning into something more serious. Another member said that although she hated Muslims, she objected to the plan. Defense lawyers tried to prove the men were just talking, and they asked Amy Cooter, an expert on militias, to give evidence. She is with Vanderbilt University's Department of Sociology in Tennessee. After reading statements and social media records and talking to one of the three men, Cooter said that Wright was more of a prepper than a militiaman. She noted there was little evidence that he trained with weapons. Cooter said Wright told her that things got out of control without him understanding what was happening. But the jury failed to accept the argument that all the men were doing was talking. Now, the three may spend their lives in prison. I'm Susan Shand.
A colorful festival in northern Thailand holds deep Buddhist meaning for young boys who are celebrated as beloved princes. The festival is held each year in the mountain town of Mae Hong Son. It ends with a parade in which the boys, some as young as 7, are carried through town on their father's shoulders. They are dressed in brightly colored clothes and highly detailed headpieces. Some villagers join the parade. They dance, beat drums, and play other instruments. The celebration is part of an ancient ceremony that ends with the boys becoming novice Buddhist monks. The boys belong to the Shan ethnic group, which lives mainly in Shan State in neighboring Myanmar. The group also spreads into parts of Thailand, China, and Laos. About 50 boys take part in the festival. It is split into different parts during a one-week period. It takes place just before the traditional Thai New Year in April, during which most villagers are home and children are on a break from school. The ceremony is meant to represent different periods in Buddha's early life as a prince. This is why the boys are called beloved princes. First, the boys have all their hair cut off. Their bodies are washed in flower-scented water. Then they are dressed in white and have colorful designs drawn on their faces. The makeup is thought to have protective qualities. At this point, the boys are considered to have reached a partly divine state. They are not permitted to touch the ground or walk by themselves until the festival is over. The process is seen as bringing honor to the boys' families. Many parents must save money for a long time to pay for costs related to the ceremony. Most families also accept donations from other family members and friends. Kasin Kong Thuy is a Thai trader. He supported one of the boys, 12-year-old Pu Sit. The boy is a family friend. "I was overwhelmed with happiness and was excited about the ceremony," Kasin told the Reuters news agency. He added that the boy told him, "Grandfather, I want to become a novice." So we helped him. "I did it to make merit." After becoming novice monks, the boys live and study at Buddhist temples for a few months during school holidays. August is an 8-year-old boy who completed the ceremony. He spoke to Reuters about his favorite part. "I liked having my head shaved," he said. He was dressed all in red and gold with a large hat holding fresh pink flowers. "When I saw my friends doing this, I decided to become a novice," he said. "I want to be the Buddha's representative. I want to be a good person." I'm Brian Lin.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. On this program, we explain common expressions that we use in everyday life. The world celebrates Earth Day every year on April 22nd. It is a day to think seriously about how our lifestyles and daily habits affect the Earth. Well, today we celebrate our shared Mother Earth with a show about Earth expressions. To which you might say, "What on earth took you so long?" Well, we think every day should be Earth Day. So let's start with the simple yet common expression, on earth. we use on Earth to make strong feelings like surprise, shock, anger, disgust, even stronger. And we use it a lot. Here are some examples. How on earth am I supposed to read this entire book in one night? What on earth are you cooking? It smells awful. Why on earth didn't you come to the party? It was awesome. I did not know what on earth she was talking about. We often use on earth in connection with choices. For example, why on earth are you going to the dance with him? He has a police record. You should go with a nice guy instead.
To the ends of the earth, I follow my star. To the ends of the earth, just to be where you are.
The earth sometimes comes up when a person wants to make big promises to someone they care about. When you say you will go to the ends of the earth for someone, it means you will do as much as possible to help them. For example, when the wife became sick, the husband went to the ends of the earth to find the best doctor to help her. A mother or father may promise to move heaven and earth to help their children. To move heaven and earth simply means that you are willing to work very hard. Now, there is a wide mix of places on earth, oceans and deserts, jungles and plains, valleys and mountains. Some places are, at times, easier to live in than others. And the word earth comes in handy to describe them. We could call a place that is beautiful, peaceful, with endless natural resources, a heaven on earth. However, heaven on earth could describe any place that has everything a person needs to be happy. Let's say you love books and reading above all else. A well-stocked library would most likely be your heaven on earth. But maybe you prefer being outdoors. A perfect outing for you would be hiking in the mountains and swimming in a clear lake. That would be your heaven on earth. Unfortunately, there is also a hell on earth. A hell on earth is a place or situation where things are so bad you feel as if you are in, well, hell. A war zone or a place destroyed by a natural disaster can become a hell on earth. But you probably know this already. It is hardly earth-shattering news. When something shatters, it breaks into many small pieces. Something would have to be terribly powerful to shatter the earth. So, when something is hardly earth-shattering, it is not surprising. We mostly use this phrase in the negative form. You can also say more simply that something is not earth-shattering. We use earth in many expressions that describe not only places, but people. Down-to-earth people are reasonable and dependable. We can also call them grounded, an adjective that goes well with the word earth. Flighty people are the opposite. You can't depend on them. They change their minds often and are very unpredictable. The expression salt of the earth comes from the Bible, the Christian holy book. It describes a very good person. For example, my neighbors are always helping out people in need. I can call them salt of the earth type people. Now, let's hear some of these expressions used in a conversation between two coworkers.
Where on earth have you been? I haven't seen you for weeks.
I was on vacation, and it was fabulous.
Oh, lucky you. Where did you go?
I vacationed on a beautiful tropical island for 2 whole weeks. I was surrounded by bright white sand, sunny skies, and a calm blue ocean.
Sounds like heaven on earth.
It was. How was your week?
Well, the office was short on staff, so I had to stay late every night.
Oh, that sounds awful.
It was hell on earth.
Well, I'm back now. How can I help?
First, I would check in with Reshma. She was promoted while you were on vacation.
She was?
Well, it's hardly earth-shattering news. I mean, she is the hardest-working person here.
That's true. I just thought that Angie would have been promoted first. She's so down to earth, and everyone likes her.
Oh, Angie's great. A real salt of the earth woman. But Reshma has moved heaven and earth to help this company.
Well, that's true. Why on earth she's still here is beyond me. I thought she would have her own company by now.
We will end this program with one more earth expression. When you promise someone the earth, you promise to give them whatever they could possibly want. Naturally, we use this in an exaggerated way. No one can give another person the earth. You know, if I write a country song, I already know what I'll name it. He promised me the earth, but all I got is dirt. And that's the end of Words and Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo. How do you use earth in your language? Let us know in the comments section.
Next is our higher education report.
Many American higher education officials agree on the need for a more balanced racial, ethnic, and cultural mix at universities and colleges. In the past, American colleges and universities placed special importance on minority or international students. But a growing number of private colleges now seek to admit more rural students. Admissions officials believe that such students have a different way of thinking than students from heavily populated areas like cities. Andrew Moe is Associate Dean of Admissions and Director of Access at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania. He said admitting students from rural areas is a natural extension of the college's inclusion goals.
The fact is that a sizable proportion of the U.S. population live in rural areas. We found through our research that about 59 million, or 20% of the U.S. population, live in rural areas.
He added that about 50% of U.S. school departments are also in rural areas. Swarthmore is a private liberal arts college near Philadelphia. Moe said that he usually goes to cities to visit high schools and meet students. This is true of most admissions officers, he said. However, he suggested, this can lead to student populations of which many members share the same outlooks and similar opinions. Moe said that Swarthmore wants students from across the country and around the world. The opinions of students from rural areas are, in his words, rich and really different than what I think is represented, really across most private colleges.
When you're in a public health class, and you're talking about access to healthcare delivery, I think a student coming from a more populated area has a very different worldview than a student coming from a more rural part. And so we want to make sure that those backgrounds and opinions are represented.
However, identifying and appealing to students from rural areas can be difficult. You can't simply call up a school, say you want to visit, and they have never heard of you, he said. He added that the first step is to build relationships with high schools and their students. Mo said that in rural areas, fewer students have friends and family able to inform them about college or the admissions process. So, it is important for admissions officers to spend time talking with students about how to prepare college admissions forms. The size of the United States means college administrators cannot possibly visit all schools personally. As a result, colleges are exploring technology for answers. Real-time video communication is one such tool to reach large groups of students. Another issue is student preparation. Mo said that studies show almost 50% of rural schools do not offer college-level studies known as advanced placement classes. However, such classes are available in more than 90% of schools in city areas. Credit in advanced placement classes can greatly help students gain admission to competitive schools. At Swarthmore, currently, only 10% of rural students seeking admission are accepted. Mo says that it is important for colleges to change their expectations and understand the issues that rural students are facing.
Most U.S. colleges also want a mix of political thinking among students. Adding rural students could help. Lynn M. Morton is president of Warren Wilson College in North Carolina. She recently told the publication Inside Higher Education that she worries that students do not have enough people around them who disagree with their opinions. Morton said she became concerned after examining results of the National Survey of Student Engagement. She found that only 23% of students at her school felt they often or very often spoke with people holding different political ideas than their own. Warren Wilson College is close to Asheville, the largest city in western North Carolina. It is considered a politically liberal city, so Morton is seeking more students from rural areas, which traditionally are more conservative.
Admissions officers at Swarthmore and Warren Wilson say they have seen small but good changes concerning future student populations. Warren Wilson has seen a 57% rise in rural students seeking admission to the school. At Swarthmore, Andrew Moe reported an increase of about 25% last year. A recent study of admissions directors found that 28% of private and 52% of public college admissions directors said they were interested in getting more rural students. "I hope it is a growing trend," said Mo. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Phil Dierking.
And that is our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from America and around the world. You can listen to us on our podcast or visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com, to find more stories, quizzes, lessons, and videos.